Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 25th of January, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to have guests, Vanessa Beely and David Scott. France.
Yes, well, we're going to get straight on with the yellow vests. And this from The Independent, yellow vest protests. France police chief repeatedly punches Gilets Jaunes activist on video. So we have a little bit of this clip here, and it is pretty horrendous how this goes. So it starts, frankly, the people that the police are pushing around here were not apparently doing anything, and suddenly the attack happens. So I'm going to say welcome to the programme, Vanessa Beely. Where do we start with this?
Well, I mean, you know, as I mentioned, I've only just got back from Syria last week, where I have to say I felt considerably safer than I do on the streets of France, which is an extraordinary statement to make. But this guy is actually a Légion d'honneur decorated police commander who was filmed not only once but twice punching civilians. Just extraordinary level of violence.
We have a little bit of video of him here. So this is the Didier Andrieu, who says that the video needs to be taken in context. What context could you possibly take this in, other than the context of the police beating up apparently demonstrators that weren't actually rioting?
No, I mean, there's absolutely no context. I mean, this is completely disproportional violence that is being meted out against unarmed civilians. These are not, you know, the current government under Macron and under the Interior Minister Christophe Castaner are trying to bring in this anti-casseur law, which is against what is called the casseurs, which are the agitators that are joining some of these protests. But even Castaner himself has admitted that those numbers of casseurs is probably less than 300 across the whole of France, so less than 50 per demonstration of Gilets Jaunes. And yet the level of violence that we're seeing, and let's make it clear, this law has not even been passed yet. But the level of violence that we're seeing carried out by the security forces, by the police factions against unarmed civilians, we've seen them being shot as they walk away. We see them being shot as they're nowhere near the police forces or the security forces while they're supposedly trying to maintain law and order. But there are no law and order infractions going on. Again, the Interior Minister has said that there are no instances of police violence against civilians. That's a clear lie by the government to protect the security forces.
Vanessa, we're gonna show a little bit of some of the injuries and so on. So we'll put a warning out right now that if you're going to be upset by this, there is that potential, because we've got to get people to understand what's actually happening. But, you know, from what you're saying here, there's a certain irony in this, that you are in France at the moment, having returned from Syria, that there were allegations in 2011 made against the Syrian government, accusing them of attacking and shooting protesters. But we didn't see the types of footage that we're about to see here. We didn't see the types of footage that the French government can't possibly deny what they've been doing. And okay, we're not talking about live rounds here, but what they are shooting and the manner in which they're shooting people is tantamount to, it's causing severe injury. In one case, somebody in a coma. It's causing people to lose limbs. It's causing people to lose eyes. But there's no outrage from the Western press or from Western governments about what the French government is doing.
No, instead, they're so busily focused on supporting the uprising, which, of course, is backed by the United States in Venezuela. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, I posted today a clip from TF1, which is one of the main state-aligned media channels in France, where they flatly deny that there have been any serious injuries, any deaths, or any police infractions against civilians. I mean, it's just an extraordinary media blackout on what is actually happening here.
Well, let's look at a couple of the sort of video clips here. So first of all, I should tell you that the person in the yellow vest here is a woman, and she has just been hit round the back of the head by a truncheon. And whenever I showed David Ellis this video yesterday, the first thing he said to me was, "Well, they could have killed her." And there was clearly no concern amongst either the person that hit her with the baton or the people that dragged her away afterwards, about the fact that there was a potential for serious injury there. Where is there any empathy with the crowd here at all being demonstrated by these police?
Well, to give you an idea of how little concern there is from within Macron's government, two examples that show that. One is that there have been in the region of 500 complaints sent against Castaner, against the interior minister. Now, those complaints have been classed as closed without any investigation by the public prosecutor. Now, the complaints were about the increase in violence, but also the repression of the ability to protest by the Gilets Jaunes, peaceful protest. That was one thing. On the 18th of this month, Macron called a meeting of all the mayors of all the communes in France. The France is divided into, I think it's now 34 communes. The mayors of each commune were invited to Souillac in northern France to discuss the problems. One mayor gave an interview immediately afterwards, and he basically said this was a complete masquerade. He said Macron came basically on an election campaign mission. He was surrounded by security. The only mayors that were allowed to speak on behalf of their constituents were those chosen by government ministers or by préfets who were present at the meeting. No Gilets Jaunes were allowed anywhere near the meeting, so none of the public was allowed to attend or even to demonstrate. If they were to be seen wearing the yellow vest, they would be charged €150 and have it removed. There was high security around the whole meeting, roadblocks set up on the roads leading into that. This isn't democracy. This is a totalitarian state that we're living in, where the representatives of the constituents in France have no say to the president. They have no recourse for any damages for what is being done to the French people, and neither do the civilians. There was an interview this morning with a young girl, a student, who was shot at a 5-meter range with a rubber bullet, an LBD-40, in Marseille. She's on about her second or third operation on a multiple fractured jaw. This is a student. When she was asked if she had had any reply from the police officer or from the police department that was responsible for her injuries, she's had none.
Right. Well, look, let's bring this website on here. This is Desarmes-en-Laye, and they have a list they seem to be holding a list of every serious injury, because you believe that the number of injured is in the thousands, but the number of serious injuries is how many?
I think it's standing, according to that list, at about 109. But there are a number of lists in circulation. I have to stress that, and there's a lot of discrepancies between them. But this seems to be quite a good one. But on that, there's about 108, 109 serious, including one 80-year-old who was killed on the 1st of December in Marseille, when a tear gas grenade exploded in their face. There are at least four amputated hands or mutilated hands, 18 eyes either severely damaged or lost, and one person has permanently lost their hearing, probably from the GILF four grenades that are being deployed in very close proximity to crowds.
So we're just looking at some of the injuries there, and they're pretty horrendous. And as I say, we're going to look at a couple more now. So just be warned about that. But you know, we're seeing tweets, and this is really social media is really the only way that this information is getting out at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there is one guy, there's a journalist, David Dufresne, and what he's doing is recording all of the police infractions. I think he's up to number 357. He's recording them on Twitter, and he's sending them to the Interior Ministry, whether they're videos or photographs, with the name, date, place of infraction, etc. But it was him that made the statement that between 2,000 and 3,000 civilians have now been lightly injured. But I mean, when we say lightly injured, we can't discount the trauma that these people are going through. You know, they're going out on what they consider to be a peaceful demonstration. They're at risk of having their jaws fractured, of having their eyes shot out, of being shot in the back of the head, of ending up in induced coma, of having limbs broken, ribs broken. I mean, this is, you know, this isn't just about being lightly injured. It's about what they see. It's about what they experience during those protests.
No, and indeed, sorry, and I say I warn people again, but that cannot be considered a light injury.
No. And I mean, this is a classic injury from these so-called defense bullets. I mean, it's a joke that that's what they're called. They have 10 times the velocity of a paintball. So anyone who's gone paintballing knows the bruises that they get on their bodies just from that. Mm. So imagine a bullet with that velocity smacking you in the face or in the back of the head, like the young fireman, the 30-year-old fireman, Olivier Béziard, who was hit in Bordeaux on the 12th of January, and he's still in an induced coma. He's a volunteer fireman with three kids.
Yes. And you know, we can see how the police are actually treating people once they manage to get them in handcuffs. And so we've got somebody covered in blood here, just being dragged along the street. And the other point to make here is how the press are now appearing on the streets. And this is quite an interesting little video clip. So they are actually going out with armour themselves.
Well, Mike, I mean, I can tell you, if I were to go and cover these protests in any city in France, and it's very likely I will do at some point, I would be wearing very similar gear. I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to risk losing an eye or getting shot in the back of the head or losing a hand. I mean, this is, you know, these grenades, the GLI F4 that are being deployed, they either contain, I think it's 165 decibels. So you can imagine if somebody is very close to one of these grenades that should never be used in a crowd environment, what they use for is if, for example, security forces are trapped in a particular area, it enables them to escape that area. It should never be used against crowds. But they will either... You don't only have the 165 decibel element. You also have the fact that they will release CS gas in powder form, which adheres itself to skin and is incredibly painful. Or you will have 10-gram rubber pellets that are released when the grenade explodes, and it contains 25 grams of TNT. And that's why you're seeing hands being literally ripped off if those grenades are deployed into a crowd. I mean, it's insane. Between 2000 and 2017, there were 46 flashball injuries from the rubber bullets. In 2 months, we have 100 injuries from the use of those bullets. And there's 80,000 police on the streets of France, Mike, during these protests. 80,000 of those, a very small percentage, are trained in the use of these firearms. So fundamentally, we have to say that the state is risking the mutilation of its own people, many of whom may have voted for Macron, by the way, during every single one of these protests. In one weekend, 10,000 tear gas grenades were used. This is not control. This is not maintenance of order. This is complete panic and provocation.
Okay, we'll just briefly look at some of the weapons being used. So we've got tear gas here. And of course, the rubber bullets. And you sent me this yesterday, which I thought was an interesting little table. Now, it's not 100% accurate because, for example, under the UK section, they've only got, truncheons. And of course, the police in the UK no longer routinely deployed with only truncheons. Now we have tasers. We've got pepper spray. We've got live fire weapons, increasingly commonplace on the streets. But nonetheless, what this table does do quite starkly is show the number of options that the French police have to deploy compared to every other major country in the EU. So they seem to have at least double what other countries have.
Yeah, I mean, this is extraordinary. This is from November 2017, I believe, from a website called ACAT, a cat, if anyone wants to go and look at it. But what is very interesting is particularly the LBD-40 bullets, the rubber bullets that I've talked about, and the JLIF-4 grenades are, to my knowledge, and that has been reported by a number of independent media outlets in France, are not used anywhere else in the EU. They're only used in France and have obviously the use has increased despite human rights defenders demanding that they be prohibited for use in crowd control. And clearly, from the injuries that we're seeing, from the trauma that we're seeing, they should be prohibited and this violence should stop. I mean, it's not only what we've talked about, it's the use of water cannon also, even against injured protesters. There's plenty of footage of the water cannon being turned on someone who's already been injured.
Mm. Yeah. You had some thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I think one of the key things here, Vanessa, is what's happening with the training of police. And I'll say that 10, maybe 15 years ago, we were getting reports of British police who were changing. Their personalities were changing after they'd gone on training courses. And relatives, wives, relatives were saying that they were seeing significant personality changes. And when we were initially investigating all those years ago, what we believed we were looking at was desensitization of the police. So basically, their empathy for the people that they're policing is dropping. They're being taught that anybody challenging them or the state is an aggressive terrorist. And now you're seeing this new vicious personality unleashed on people. This is apparent in UK in some circumstances. It's certainly happening in Europe. And of course, what have we got going on? We've got joint police training. So we've got the European Police College that's been training our own police college here in the UK. And the other thing that's been happening, of course, is the increasing militarization of the police. Now, in France, you've got a military version of the police anyway, but it's safe to say that French police are much closer to a military condition than they are in UK. But of course, the more you militarize your police, the more you're actually going to be having people who think they're fighting a war instead of policing people on the streets. So we need to look at who is devising the training policy, not only for the French police, but for the police here in UK.
Well, let me just bring this and remind everybody of this. This is a NATO tweet from a couple of years ago. Non-lethal weapons provide options to troops who are faced with uncertainty. We're seeing, you know, if we're handing those out to police, as this tweet says, but if troops are really given non-lethal weapons, does this mean they're no longer soldiers? They're policemen doing law and order. And as we've mentioned already a number of times in this program, if we go back to November 2015, when EU's High Representative Federica Mogherini and Jens Stoltenberg from NATO were speaking at the European Defence Agency conference, that was exactly the point they were making, that they want to merge military and policing functions.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to end this off, Vanessa, that seems to be what we're seeing on the streets, police behaving like military. And I did notice in some of the video that quite a large number of the so-called police that were there were in civilian clothes. They had armbands, perhaps, but it would be very easy for somebody who's in civilian clothes with an armband to take the armband off, put a yellow vest on, and behave slightly differently in order to provoke activity. Mm. So the whole thing, beginning to merge as an institution, the sort of policing and militarized systems. You know, this is totalitarian, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think one thing I want to make clear, there is evidence of collaboration also between France and Israel, as of course there is between the US and Israel on training police. And if I look at some of the images and if I look at some of the brutality that's being meted out against civilians, it reminds me very much of the Zionist suppression of Palestinian demonstrations and protests, particularly, you know, in the occupied territories. So it's clear that this violence is coming in, as Brian suggested, from a number of areas, but it is absolutely terrifying because, as someone said this morning in an interview, in fact, it was one of the people who've been injured, they said there is a complete rupture of dialogue. There is no dialogue. This is literally naked aggression. The brandishing of arms against students, against medical nurses, against the elderly, against disabled. I mean, there's absolutely no delineation between these protesters. They come from left, right, centre, from all different backgrounds. They are the French population going out on the streets to protest the social conditions that they're now being forced to live in. And their views are being completely marginalised by the government. And they're being punished, collectively punished, for having those views by state security, by state-sanctioned violence.
OK, look, Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us today for that. That has been fantastic. Let me bring David Scott into the programme. David, what are your thoughts on what you've seen in the first half of the programme there?
Well, it's very shocking, but while you were talking, I was doing a little searching on Google under the title of Violence Against Yellow Vest Protesters. The number one article is the following: Reuters, Paris, French media and reporters organizations denounced attacks on journalists by the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters and call for better protection. That's quite typical. You go down the list and you see many UK media sources like the Telegraph stood out reporting the French government line that the violence is coming from the protesters and the police are free from any wrongdoing whatsoever. That doesn't tally with what we're seeing on social media and what we're hearing from Vanessa, and it doesn't tally with the list of injuries.
Yes. OK, well, look, thank you very much, Vanessa. We've got to move on. David, we're going to move to Scottish issues. And, well, the big story in Scotland at the moment is Alex Salmond, of course, who has been, accused. Yesterday, it took a long time for us to discover what he had been accused of. Give us an update on what he is accused of and how this has come to be.
Well, there's 14 charges. They are two charges of attempted rape, one of breach of the peace, a couple of indecent assault, and the rest, 9 charges of sexual assault. Now, you said that it took us a wee while to find out just what was going on. This is true, because this was in a secret court. In fact, the first thing we knew about this in Scotland, or anywhere else, was Alex Salmond's public announcement outside the court. There's a letter in the paper today, which I'll just read to you, a short one. So the secrecy of Scotland's justice system was in full view to the world yesterday. Alex Salmond protested his innocence on live TV around 2:30 p.m. Yet we'd no idea what he'd been charged with. The accusations had been read to him and his lawyer by a sheriff in a secret court. After 3 p.m, the Crown Office released a summarised list. So, you know, secret courts, and we're having this on. There are many strange aspects of this, because we had a government inquiry into this, which was botched, which Mr. Salmond challenged to judicial review, and the government case fell apart on day one of the judicial review, we understand, to avoid certain documents coming into the public domain. And then after that, civil, essentially kind of employment type tribunal, after that, the police got involved, which is a strange order right away. And we have now 14 charges. Now, Mr. Salmond is very clear. He's saying that that nothing he did passed the threshold of criminality, and that he denies all these charges. And he's looking to the Scottish courts for justice. Now, I winced when I heard that, because we know otherwise in Scotland. But we have a situation here where we've got a secret court, We have the person most directly in charge of the prosecution, the Lord Advocate, is a political appointee and sits in the cabinet. So it's all very political. It's very concerning in many ways.
The comment you made to me yesterday was that, of course, Police Scotland are effectively political as well.
Well, Police Scotland have had the Chief Constable appointed recently by the Scottish Police Authority, who are, quote, independent, one of these independent quangos, but independent quangos staffed by people appointed by high government officials and members of the cabinet. The accusations in the past of the Chief Constable, Ian Livingston, includes accusations of sexual assault, which are even more severe than the ones Mr. Salmond is facing. Now, there was an investigation by the police into this, and eventually he was cleared and his career recovered and he's made this high office. But we have a situation where we have, when we reach someone of Mr. Salmond's fame and political standing, these decisions will only be made by the very highest. So it's the Chief Constable Ian Livingston will be making these decisions personally, and it will be the Lord Advocate James Wolfe who will be making these decisions personally. So you're now having decisions made in a very tightly controlled way by a group of people who know one another. So if there is some political agenda at play here, the nature of the Scottish system and the secrecy involved in the Scottish system will give it full rein.
I understand there are some pretty draconian reporting restrictions on this. Are you aware of what those are in terms of the actual allegations themselves?
I'm not in detail, but the first tweet I saw on this from a very experienced journalist said basically this is the last tweet I'll be making. So from our point of view, we'll be talking about what's in the press and the front pages of the paper, and that will be about it, because there will be very tightly controlled restrictions. And there is already contempt of court proceedings underway somewhere in Scotland to do with this case.
Let's just have a look at some of the front pages. So we've got the Daily Express with accused. We've got the Daily Record listing the 14 charges. We've got The Sun listing the charges in a different way, and the Scottish Daily Mail the same. The Courier, I am innocent, and the National, Salmon faces sex assault charges. Now, I noticed, by the way, sorry, I don't know how much you can say about this, but just as a general comment, the breach of the peace charge, you have made a point about breach of the peace before, David. This seems to be a catch-all crime. I'm not asking you to say why that was applied in this case, but just as a general comment about breach of the peace, it seems to apply to everybody.
Yes, it was surprising to see with such a long list of charges that breach of the peace, which is relatively minor compared to the others, was thrown in as well. And I obviously don't know any of the details of what that refers to, but breach of the peace is the most abused charge in Scotland. It's used as a means of social control. It essentially is used when people are doing something the state doesn't want them to do very often. Now, there's many legitimate uses for breach of the peace charges as well, but it tends to be abused greatly by the state. And this has been recognised by academics. One professor of law, Aberdeen University, has written a book on the subject and is basically calling for people to stop rolling over and pleading guilty to this, because it's just been abused on a routine basis.
Yeah, and just finally to end this section, I take it you don't assume there's any connection between the Scottish establishment seeming to have turned on Alex Salmond and his decision that he would produce programmes for RT or through RT?
I don't think that's the motivation. Your characterisation that the Scottish establishment has turned on Alex Salmond, though, does seem to be credible.
Okay, let's move on then. In 1994, on the 2nd of June, an RAF Chinook helicopter crashed on the Mull of Kintyre in Scotland. That crash, they said, happened because of foggy conditions and so on. 25 passengers, 4 crew on board, all died. That included almost all of the UK senior Northern Ireland intelligence experts. In 1995, an RAF Board of Inquiry decided that it was impossible to establish the exact cause of the accident. That ruling was overturned then by two senior reviewing officers who decided that the pilots were guilty of gross negligence, for flying too fast and too low in thick fog. That finding of negligence was then challenged in subsequent years by the House of Commons Defence Committee and also the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee. And in 2002, the two RAF pilots were cleared of blame for the crash by a subsequent inquiry, which was held by Lord Jauncey. But the government refused to agree with that decision. And then in 2009, the Daily Telegraph revealed documents published on the day of the crash saying that the Chinook was not fit for service and should be grounded. And in 2010, leaked Ministry of Defence documents suggested that there were serious concerns that software on board the aircraft was positively dangerous. Liam Fox was the Defence Secretary at the time. He announced that there would be an independent review of the crash. And for several years, I think if I remember rightly, it was from around 2007 until 2011 or so, Computer Weekly was the main publication that was campaigning on the basis that there was clear evidence of problems with the FADEC engine management software. And in 2011, MOD documents were discovered which indicated there were concerns over airworthiness 2 years before the crash. And then finally, on the 13th of July 2011, Liam Fox, still the Defence Secretary, apologised to the families of the two RAF pilots after an independent review led by Lord Phillips had cleared them of negligence. So, as I say, there were 25 counterinsurgency or counterterrorism personnel, intelligence personnel on the helicopter. It is a bit strange that they were all on one helicopter. I don't think if you were in the operating in the commercial world that you would have all your key staff on a single flight or a single helicopter. That's just nuts. So there've been many questions about this case, about this incident over the years. Nonetheless, who, for example, took the decision for that arrangement and so on, lots of people campaigning, families and friends of the families and fellow servicemen campaigning to have these have the truth come out about this. But the problem is, as the newsletter, the Belfast newsletter is reporting here, truth about Mull of Kintyre Chinook may be lost if files are destroyed this year. So they say that the Ministry of Defence has confirmed to the newsletter that all files relating to the crash, which were closed in 1995-96, will be reviewed this year for disposal or disclosure under the 30-year rule. A spokesperson said records were closed in 1995 and 1996 will be reviewed for release or alternative disposal this year. These reviews have not been completed and the decision will be made in due course. One of the campaigners, Brian Dixon, put a petition up on the petition on the government website, the government's petition website, he said, the petition said, ensure all records relating to the Chinook crash in 1994 are archived at Kew. The Chinook crash on the Mull of Kintyre on 2nd of June 1994 resulted in the loss of 29 souls. The pilots of the Chinook were wrongly blamed for the accident, resulting in a 17-year fight to clear their names. It was eventually proved that the MOD had wrongly blamed the deceased pilots. This 17-year miscarriage of justice brought about immense public support, several parliamentary debates in both houses, early day motions, reports from the National Audit Office, and countless items of correspondence to and from the Ministry of Defence. Collectively, this is an important record of MOD and RAF failings, and the loss of this would be detrimental to providing important learning opportunities for military leaders. So that petition went up a few days ago, and as you can see, it was taken straight down again because five people had the opportunity to sign Brian Dixon's petition before the government took that, or at least Parliament took that petition down. They're checking the petition to see if it meets the petition standards before we publish it. Brian, I don't know what your thoughts on what I've just read out there, but I don't see anything in that that could possibly be outside of any kind of standards for a petition other than it accurately reflects the facts that the Ministry of Defence and the government tried to incorrectly label two pilots as being to blame for something.
Well, I think it's been taken down because in the background there's stuff that we don't know about. The public's never been told about what happened. So the government is scared that if this begins to roll, there's going to be information that comes out. It's all secrecy. We live in UK in 2018, 2019 now, where basically everything is shut down, hidden, child abuse records shut off for 50, 60, 90 years. Documents are given under freedom of information, but heavily redacted. Secret courts, as Dave has just been alluding to. It's no wonder. I think they're very frightened, and I think there's a lot more to this crash than meets the eye.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, let's move on. Integrity Initiative, there has been a new disclosure of documents. And this man here, Alexander John Finnan, seems to feature quite well. Now, one of the things they say, aside from the release of documents, is that the Foreign Commonwealth Office's Chief Propaganda Officer, Andy Price, helped Chris Donnelly, who's the leader of Integrity Initiative, to place Alex Finnan in the Foreign Commonwealth Office as a senior advisor to HM Government's Russia Unit Counter Disinformation and Media Development Programme. After that, Finnan demanded that any information about his involvement with the Institute of Statecraft be immediately deleted from the website. And then it goes on to say that afterwards, millions of pounds of the Britain's taxpayers' money began flowing to the Institute of Statecraft as part of the project that included Donnelly's agent. Now, corruption here is quite obvious. Now, this is what Anonymous is saying. Now, so the question is it correct? Well, if we go back to the Institute for Statecraft website, I just chose a date in 2016, I think that is. And indeed, Alex Finnan is listed there as a senior fellow of the Institute for Statecraft. If you go to the Institute for Statecraft's website today, Alex Finnan is not listed. So that bit itself does check out. However, if we look at his CV, and we'll just read this out. It says, Executive Officer Specialist Group Military Intelligence, born in June 1952. He served at first in the Corps of Royal Engineers, where he was promoted to captain in 1994 and then major in 1999, transferred to the Intelligence Corps, went to the to the Parachute Regiment, went back to the Intelligence Corps. And then he described himself in a civilian role. He described himself as a retired member of the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So he has a long history with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which seems to not quite tally with what Anonymous is saying here. I'm not saying they're wrong yet, but I can't say that they're right either. Now, that particular CV that you see on screen at the moment has come from the Working Group on Syria Propaganda and Media. This is Piers Robinson's group, Professor Piers Robinson's group. Do go and have a look at their coverage of this, of the Integrity Initiative. They have some good documentation on it. But within this particular Anonymous drop, they had this to say. This was their version of a CV. They said that Alex has been directly engaged in this area for a number of years. This is a specialist group military intelligence. He was also a member of a team with Di Allen and John Hazel working on the development's concept of employment in the area of, and that's been redacted. In particular, Alex, having previously developed both the CONEMP and the training needs analysis for materiel and personnel exploitation within the Ministry of Defence, was responsible for the training needs analysis in this later project. Alex served for 16 years of his career in the Western Balkans on behalf of the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the Ministry of Defence, plus further periods in the Levant and the former Warsaw Pact. He has spent much of his career as an intelligence analyst, but his other major career strand has been with elections. And he was Director General for Elections in Bosnia for six rounds of elections and co-chair for the biometric ID card and passport project in Albania. And so it goes on. So he clearly is, I mean, what is this man, Brian? He is clearly...
He's an operative, Mike. This is the only thing you can describe this man is as a government operative. So he's got a military background, but he's then into very dark and difficult to... It's difficult to see exactly what he's doing. But he's there in the Balkans. So what's he doing in the Balkans? Mind bending, changing people's minds, getting them to vote the right way in elections. This is a deep state man. That's a good description, because it starts to mean that you have to ask questions.
So the anonymous are saying that Chris Donnelly organised with Andy Price to have this man brought into the Foreign Office, and that after that, money started going in the other direction. Now, the question is, how do we establish that? And at this point, of course, it's impossible to establish that, because, as I've mentioned before, I have had a Freedom of Information request into the Foreign Commonwealth Office with regard to Andy Price. That came to a head at around Christmas time, when the Information Commissioner's Office went and met with the Foreign Commonwealth Office to try and get some of the information that I wanted released. This was basically what came back. The Foreign Office has explained to the Information Commissioner's representative that in addition to Section 24, National Security, it also considers Section 27, International Relations, and Section 40, Personal Data, of the Freedom of Information Act to apply to the information falling within the scope of your request. Now, just to clarify once again, the scope of my request was, what is the scope, or what are the terms of reference for Andy Price's department, and how many people does he have working for him? I wasn't asking for any personal data. I wasn't asking for any specific information about the projects that they're working on. I just wanted to know the general terms of reference for the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Programme. And I wanted to know the number of people that are working for them. So it has to be said, we are not going to find out through Freedom of Information, it seems, whether this man is working with Andy Price at the Foreign Commonwealth Office. I just want to say once again that you know, the Foreign Office, when they refused that Freedom of Information request from me, Brian, have changed their tune about why they're refusing it on three or four separate occasions now.
It's a bit like asking Freedom of Information questions about common purpose. Certainly in the early days, it used to change from day to day, week to week, what sort of response you got.
Yes. So here is Andy Price, for anybody that doesn't know what he looks like. This is his Twitter page. Of course, his tweets are protected, so you can't see what he's tweeting about. David, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's fascinating, and I think we'll get a lot more information from this last anonymous release, and it's good to see other organisations pushing the research in this. We're into the deep state. We're not meant to know. And the Russians are the bad guys, and we're going to be manoeuvring the country into a position together with the whole of Europe to confront those nasty Russians. And the voters, the people, it's above our pay grade. We must be kept in the dark. Presumably, we are all viewed as security risks.
Well, indeed. Yes.
I'm sure we'll find out in due course.
Yes. Now, Brian, I'm interested in your view of this. Here we are. Johnny Mercer had an article in Telegraph today, and somebody tweeted out about that article, and they got a response. First of all, from Marina Hyde, who is a Guardian journalist, and she said, "Wait, was he in the army? But why didn't he mention it before?" Now, this is a slightly sarcastic remark, perhaps, but nonetheless, I was just interested in your thoughts about Johnny Mercer's response. Because he responded by saying, "You'll find I go on about it less than anyone else. Apologies for having a career before politics that I refer back to occasionally. Perhaps I should have done something worthy with my life and become a left-wing gobshite masquerading as a serious journalist." Brian, I don't know, you know, how do we react to that? Is this the way for a member of parliament to behave?
Well, of course it's not. And He changed his role. If he wanted to be out there on the field with his lads using this sort of language, then of course he was entitled to do it. But he's changed his job. This is the Johnny Mercer that's been given a lot of information about the fact that Britain's armed forces are being given away to EU Defence Union. He doesn't want to know about that. He doesn't want to know what's happening with the general shutdown of the military in Plymouth. In fact, we're blocked from his Twitter page at the moment. Mm. We are now seeing what's inside Johnny Mercer, and it's not very nice. And yet this is the man who's sitting there on defence committees, supposedly acting in with great intelligence and wisdom and knowledge. This tweet is starting to show what sort of man you're dealing with. I know there was a bit of laughter going on there in the background. And of course, I'm going to say it's too easy to laugh about these things. If they want the position, they want the responsibility. He wants to sit there as a member of parliament. I say he should behave like one. Well, briefly, maybe that's an oxymoron in its own right.
Well, there. Indeed. Just briefly, David.
I was laughing. I was laughing because what was happening there was something that's very unusual, and it was an authentic reaction. Should he have expressed himself that way? No, I don't think he should. And it does show a certain degree of thin-skinnedness, which is a bit strange because, you know, what does it matter what she says? Anything. I mean, we've got to a point that anything that's authentic, anything that's actually real, is a relief these days.
Yes. Okay.
You've let him off.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we leave it there?
You just need on one of these from David here because I think. Excuse me. Just a minute. One of these does link in. I think with. David, you got several here from your one about the hospital, but I thought there was one that linked in directly with what we were talking about, which was to do with behaviour. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was the Russia infiltration one. So it's this one here, Mike, if we can just pop through to that. You mentioned the fact that, of course, everybody was being briefed against those nasty Russians with Integrity by Integrity Initiative. And it seemed to me this fitted the bill.
Yeah, this is an absolutely remarkable piece, right? So this is Russia infiltration not taken seriously by some. And this is Stuart MacDonald, who is the SNP defence spokesman, right? And he writes here, he's reported in the Times, and he says, Russia is sowing division and confusion in the Scottish independence campaign. Now, that alone is a hysterically funny comment because, you know, why would they? If Russia's attacking Britain, they would want to break up Britain, right? No, apparently the Russians are attacking the SNP. Employing Alex Salmond, but we'll come to that in a minute. The SNP's defence spokesman is warned. Stuart MacDonald said the nationalist grassroots and some senior politicians were too quick to dismiss evidence of the infiltration. He accused Kremlin-backed broadcasters at RT and Sputnik of being a malign influence alongside fake news and propaganda. So here you see the SNP just putting forward exactly the line from Integrity Initiative, etc., yeah. Almost word for word. Right? And he then says... It's a stated foreign policy objective of Russia to find opportunities to sow division and confusion and exploit it in a malign way. Russia today is openly an arm of that architecture. Its own director has stated that on record. So that's what the politician said. Now, what RT said about this was that that's not true. They said, let me get the quote, I can't spot it right now, but basically RT said, no, that's not true. We never said that. That didn't happen. That would be fake news, actually. There you go.
Okay. Well, David, we'll end it there. I think we're going to cover some more items of news in our after news discussion, which, of course, UK column members can watch. We'll just end with this. We're going to say, please join the UK column community if you're not already a signed up member with us. But we need your support. We need your donations. And if you can assist with that way, we can only do what we do with your financial support. I'm going to end on this note that we can tell you today that it's no longer certain that Melanie Shaw is being held in HM prison style. She's definitely not been released. We are trying to establish where she is at the moment. But this is very, very sinister that we've now got people simply disappearing inside Britain's prison gulag to match those secret courts, the redacted information, and of course the violence by the state against his own citizens. We'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us. UK Column will be back at the same time on Monday.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.